Hi, you're listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in.
And to all you lovely people for creating some amazing weather. Fabulous. I'm going to get the weather you deserve this weekend. Well, good evening and thank you for having me. Can you all hear me okay?
Nice near the mic, I think is the trick.
A bit more? Better? Better. Better? Cool. Who have we got in the room? Just throw me some names.
Simon,
hello. Ian, hello. John, hello. Where's the ladies? Alison, Jackie, who else? Andrew. Another Andrew. Any more? David, thank you all for coming. Thank you for having me. Thank you for having me. It's my great pleasure to be here. I live just about an hour down the road, so perfect, beautiful Friday evening drive out. Now, this evening, I'm your stand-in for Peter Holbrook, a great friend and colleague of mine. The great thing is we have some different views on things. So if you get to see Peter build again, you can still go and see him again. We agree on lots, but disagree on some very important things. But that's what makes the world go round, hey. Well, this evening, I thought I'd talk about three things. Firstly, I'm going to talk about social enterprise, for me, my personal journey, how I ended up here, because I think it's really interesting when we talk about our own personal journeys of why we do what we do and what we would rather be doing, or are we living our dream already? Then I'm going to talk a little bit about our business model. So again, a first-hand experience of what it's like at Blue and what we actually do, what is our social purpose and how does it work. And then I'm going to close by hopefully talking a little bit about the potential of social enterprise. And hopefully by then I'll have you all on board and you'll all be wanting to launch your own social enterprises if you don't already. So can I just ask for a show of hands? Does anybody work in a social enterprise right now? Okay, we've got a lot to win over, guys. Any of you dreamed of starting your own business? Ever? Okay, about a third, at least a third, maybe half. And if you're going to start your own business, or if you have your own business already, why?
Flexibility.
Flexibility, I love that one. I work a four-day week. Sorry?
Self-management,
yeah, doing it your way. Ego. Did somebody say ego? Good ego can be a good thing, right? It's not just all about big ego. Anything else? Great answer. Nobody's doing it right. Okay, you are not my typical audience. Nobody's mentioned money, and yet you're all sitting there thinking the same thing as me. And I guess this is why this room tonight is filled with potential. Because the business world, as we know it, the norm that we're trying to counter in social business, the primary motivator, and when we talk about things like shareholder value, what we really mean is cash. So it probably comes as no surprise when I tell you I was a little bit miserable in my job in banking. I'd spent the 13 years before I moved to banking pretty happy, actually. I was a magazine publisher. And I published magazines like Country Walking, Trail, Birdwatching Magazine, The Garden, Garden News. And I loved that job. I loved that job because everybody I worked with was living their passion. They were living their dream. Every day they were getting to do or write about what they wanted to do. Everybody was happy. And I was filled with purpose because I was helping them be happy. And we were making magazines. And we were helping people who were average at trout fishing get better at trout fishing, or people who were okay at gardening get better at gardening. And I was so happy, and then I left. But it was okay, I left for love. So very long story cut short, my husband was a magazine buyer at WH Smith's. I was the publisher in charge of all these specialist magazines. I presented a new relaunch of a practical photography magazine. We fell in love because he was holding a Photography Monthly pen, that was the competitor. I told him he was horrible for doing that. Next thing I know, we went to dinner. I got all the shelf space I wanted and we got married and lived happily ever after. But it was a little bit of a conflict. And I've always, I guess even back then, was very clear for me what was wrong and what was right. And it felt awkward. And we became the subject of a board conversation at WH Smith's and at EMAP that competitors were saying we were advantaged. And And I thought, you know, they're right, time to move on. One of us needs to get a new job. And I was offered an amazing job at Barclays. Now, nothing wrong with Barclays. Anyone work at Barclays? Anybody work in banking, in finance? Okay, I'm safe to speak. So I worked for 6 years at Barclays. Huge resources, huge period of learning, huge amounts of things to do and change to make. None of it fulfilling. I tried to make it fulfilling. I tried to make it a better place than my way. I tried to think more about customers, and I got quite a lot of support for that. I was in charge of 3,000 branches. 30,000 people were my target audience to get on board to try and live the Barclays brand. I did everything I could, and I still found it really, really demoralizing. It was a bank. And there's nothing wrong with banks. We need somewhere to look after our savings. We need someone to look after, to borrow from when we want to buy our houses. But I was completely without personal purpose. And one day I read a book about something called Ikigai. Anybody come across that? No? Want to type into the phones? Yes, I've got a nod in the audience. It's a Japanese concept about finding your personal place of purpose and your most rewarding place of being. It's a combination. You can sum it up in one diagram with four overlapping circles about something the world needs, something you like to do. You're also good at it, and you can get paid for it. And when those things all overlap in the middle, that's when you're productive, you're industrious, you feel good, you develop mastery, and you're able to live. And what better place can there be in the world than that? So I discovered this concept of Ikigai and promptly resigned from my very well-paid job. My husband was very supportive, on the surface anyway, and he said, it's okay, you've got about 6 months, love, before we'll have to ask for a reduction on our mortgage repayment. So I had 6 months to figure out what I wanted to do and what my personal purpose would be. And so I started writing down what I was good at. I could run businesses. I did a lot of brand and marketing. I knew how to run a P&L. I was good at cash. I was very well organized. And I decided I either wanted to be an organic pig farmer or retrain as a midwife, work for my favorite charity, or retrain as a vicar. Now, my husband was a bit thrown with the last one because we weren't exactly regular churchgoers. He wasn't, me more regularly than him. But of course, this was my point. You know, this is the opportunity to reinvent the church and to be more inclusive. And this is a place to everyone. And the best wedding I've ever been to was when the minister said to a grumpy mother when her daughter was getting married in Barbados, says, "Madam, this is all God's church." And I was inspired by that because he had his purpose and I wanted purpose like that. I wanted everyone to be happier and better off. But I kind of quickly came round to, you know, his point of view. It was a bit of a leap from where we were at. And so I followed his coaching, which was to write to my favourite charities, because charities are good places to work and they're good people and that would be fine. But my favourite charities didn't write back to me. They didn't know what to do with somebody like me. I told them all the things I could do to help and I'll come and work for free. But I think, to be honest, I was probably just a little bit too scary in my enthusiasm to help make the world a better place. And so I did what many people in my position do, and I ended up doing some interim and consultancy for a bit. But that was okay. I'm going to meet lots of new people, have lots of new experiences, and therefore along the way I'll find out what it is I'm supposed to do. At that point, I just decided rather than have a leap of faith to something else, I'd already made one leap and it wasn't going very well, I was just going to have faith and we would get there. And so I ended up working for Audi on an interim basis. My husband loved that job. I got a new car every 2 weeks. Made him really happy. I don't care about cars, but I care about him being happy. And just the week before we got the R8, anyone know what that is? Good for you, but I don't really care, but he did. Just before we got the really swanky number, I fell off my horse and broke my leg. I got a driver instead. He was gutted. And that's when my journey into social enterprise started. I had had a huge amount of pain while my leg was in cast. I got some amazing pain relief, drugs. First time in my life ever I'd had anything that strong. And I started to have some amazing ideas. And at that time, so honestly, I'm not kidding you, don't knock until you've tried it. There's a whole other story I need to tell about up the gas and air and sitting, thinking I was an X Factor whilst waiting for the X-ray, but that's a whole other story. But seriously, that's the point of my time when I just got out of that routine of normal thinking. I wasn't busy. I couldn't go anywhere. I was sat on the sofa in bed with my leg up, taking lots of pain relief. And I started reading, and I was reading The Guardian, and I came across an advert for this thing I'd never heard of, which was called Blue. And it was an advert about trying to save the planet, but it was bottled water. And I'm thinking, what on earth are they on about? Surely that is an oxymoron in itself. So I forgot about it. Couldn't let it go, went back to it. And I did some investigation. And at that time, I guess my job would have been brand consultant. And I looked at what they were doing and decided I was going to write to them and give them a little bit of peace of my mind. 2 pages of a business plan of what they should do instead of what they are doing. Because at that point in time, that business had lost £1.9 million trying to do a good thing, trying to show the world that they needed to consume less, certainly didn't need to have single-use bottled water, and it wasn't working. And my theory at that point was there's a big difference between being socially minded and wanting to make a difference in the world and being business minded and knowing how to make it work. So at this point, I didn't realize what I was writing was a business plan for a social enterprise, because at that point, this was late in 2009, nobody knew those words social enterprise, or if you did, you were in the minority of a minority. So completely by accident, I ended up being the chief executive of a business, because I went into a room having been asked to consult on could they sell the brand and recoup some of the millions, to say nobody's going to buy it because what you've done is you've told everybody who's interested that they're really bad. Now, single-use products and packaging and consumption, as we all know, isn't a good thing. But buying the odd bottle of water or the odd bottle of shampoo you can't refill doesn't make you a bad person. It's a bigger journey that we need to go on together. And what we need to do in socially minded businesses is inspire people to take them together somewhere better. Not tell them they're bad, not fill them with greenwash, not just counter everything they've believed previously with something else that's different. We need to help people understand and do different. So thinking about that, it was in, and what do we do? What do we do differently? Of course, the big question is if you want to have a business that's social and with purpose, it still has to be a business. It has to make money. So how do you do that? And what does that mean? And the reason I like talking... Does everybody heard about Baloo, by the way? Does everybody recognise that? You're a bit further north than most of my audiences. If you're in a restaurant, Café Rouge, Strada, Jamie's Italian, Bella Italia, Zizi's, you might have seen something that looks a little bit like that. Or you might have seen filtered water that looks a little bit like that. So the idea was, what if we started a business that actually had purpose at every level? It would be completely asset locked. Nobody could ever get rich from it. So we would, from day one, be able to show to everyone that we're trying to do a good thing. And we would do 2 things. We would promise that in the market, and bear in mind this is a £4 billion market, that was still growing. Still is growing, actually, that the products would guarantee that from an environmental perspective, everything would set a benchmark. Every bottle would be made from bottles, back into bottles, back into bottles, back into bottles. It would use as little material as possible. It would have the lowest carbon footprint possible in terms of transport miles. And then we would account for that fully, offset that so it was carbon neutral by investing in reforestation or hydro projects. And then the monies that we did make, every single penny of the money that we'd make would go to water aid for those who don't have access to clean water, so are suffering themselves with water poverty. Now, arguably, if you can get away with going to a tap and turning it on, you don't need any of that. So we would say to people, you know, buying the odd bottle of mineral water doesn't make you a bad person. But when you do want to buy one, please buy a bottle of Blue. And so there we were with a competitive set of people like Evian and San Pellegrino, Badoit, Hilden Water, a whole mix of imports, lots of food miles, privately owned businesses owned by Coke and owned by Nestle, doing a great job to make shareholders rich and doing it as cost effectively as they could to maximise profit. And we're a tiny little business, so we're not going to make any difference, are we, in our own little bit? And our ambitions in the early days were very small. I wanted to do two things. I wanted to find a way to pay back the £1.9 million worth of debt. And I wanted to be able to give £100,000 a year to Wartrade. Now, paying back the debt was not something we had to do. We could have wound up and started again. But for me, it was about saying there's value in everything. We want to, you know, people these days are too, they put too much pressure on themselves to get everything right. And if they don't get it right, to kind of forget it. I don't think we actually spend enough time embracing when we do get it wrong and the learning and making something good come out of that. So I was really determined that we would do that. And it took us 3 years to pay back that debt. And in 3 years, we also gave £300,000 to Wartrade. So that was a huge success. And I couldn't quite believe it. So I thought, right, where do we go now? And of course, you do what every sensible person would do 3 years in when it's been a success. You start to take it easy, or you give yourself £1 million a year target. And so that's what we did. And the reason we gave ourselves a target was not for target's sake. It was to inspire us to have more impact. And not because actually £1 million per annum was the important point. It was about getting to be a big enough size in the marketplace and being disruptive enough in the marketplace that, you know what, the big brands and the big businesses would try a little bit harder. And I think that, to me, is the essence of social enterprise. We've got two jobs to do. One is we need to exemplify what can be done, whether it's in childcare or education or in chocolate or in handbags or in healthcare or in dentists or whatever it is how do we exemplify what it looks like when you're focused on value for us all, for doing the right thing? And if we exemplify that in our piece, and we do it with enough noise and enough gusto and enough passion and enough resilience to get you through all of those things, is what if other people start to look? Surely in their boardrooms, they're going to go, hang on a minute, if blue bottles are made with at least 50% recycled plastic, and this was back in 2012, we should do that. And they did try a little bit. We started to hear press commitments of by 2016 and by 2017, we'd use 20% and 30%. But actually, when David Attenborough came on with Blue Planet and the world suddenly started to listen about the need for a circular economy and that everything we use, we need to reuse, all of a sudden, because we had 7 years of using bottles to make bottles, it was very, very easy for the market this year to switch. And so we've seen a great trend towards that. And we take a moment at Blue to go, on our own, we've done some great things, but actually some of the biggest successes we have are in how we've helped our competitors. By giving them data and by evidencing that there's less risk. And if I could just give another example to bring that to life. Most of our business has been in glass. Glass is a much more appropriate product for where we do most of our business in restaurants. We only supply plastic when people have to do places like Airside or where they've had it at festivals because glass hasn't been allowed. And glass has a big carbon footprint. Its carbon footprint is nearly as bad as aluminium, actually, although it doesn't use quite so much fossil fuel, its raw material. And the reason that it's also bad is it's really flipping heavy. So we started asking the questions, this is back in 2014, why is it so heavy? And we talked to glass manufacturers and they said, because everybody's happy with it. You know, why don't you want it so heavy? It looks expensive. And I'm going, but surely if you use less glass, it would use less raw materials and it would incur less carbon. And they went, yeah, you're probably right. So shall we do some drawings? And so here we are, a small business, about 3% market share at that point. And we're sitting with glass designers going, we're designing the lightest weight glass bottle in the world. How on earth are we going to take this to market? But you don't worry about that if you're a social enterprise, because by nature, you're innovative, you're creative, you're determined. You're a little bit bullish at times until somebody brings you back. But you're determined and you're resilient. And so we came up with a design where we knew we could take 18% of the carbon footprint out of a bottle that was used for sparkling water. And we figured out we could make it happen if we did two things. One is we just had to make the commitment in terms of volume to the manufacturers, and we had to make the commitment of volume and the term, and then we had to be able to sell it. And at that point, we realized whilst we were doing quite well, we probably weren't going to sell it all under our own brand on our own. So we did trademark what we call ethical glass. we made part of that product being every bottle has a royalty that goes to Wartrade. And what we did was we started to speak to our competitors. So rather than keeping the competitive advantage of being able to go to our customers and say, our bottle's the lightest you can get, it's the best, we actually said, our brand and our product is the best anyway, because we're the partner of Wartrade. We give all of our profits away. Everybody else doesn't. And everybody's natural mineral water in the UK tastes amazing. So the real differentiator here is our model. And when it comes to the glass, actually, what's the best thing for us as a social enterprise to do? Is it to keep that IP for ourselves and try and be a little bit better? Or is it to share that and actually market and sell that glass to our competitors so their carbon footprint can reduce too? And that's what we did. And that, for me, was one of the most exciting times at Blue, because not because we sold more, but because we were able to sit round the table with our competitors and genuinely look into their eyes and see them move, see them get that. Actually, by thinking about reducing, you know, how much carbon emissions they create as they produce their product, could actually be good for business. Because guess what? The product I was able to sell them cost less to make, therefore cost less them to buy. And I think that's just a great example of how social enterprises can be really, really innovative. Now, as you kindly said earlier, we're a business full of innovation, because we have to be. We have to be because we don't like to spend any money. There's a statistic that we talk about. I'm sure you guys already know it, in water poverty. It's called a wash cost. It only costs £15 to transform one life long-term through access to clean water, a decent toilet and hygiene education in any one of the 28 countries where Wartrade works. And you know what? That's a real leveller. You know, I have spent £15 on a bottle of wine, not very often. I'm more than £7 or £8. Anybody with me? £7 or £8? Or are you, yeah, sometimes less. It's 25% off if you buy six or more at Tesco's currently. But, you know, on a special occasion, I've been known to spend £15 on one bottle of wine. And I find it really hard, actually. So if I stop and think about it, and that's one life transformed, it's a really difficult thing to get your head around. I could have not had that wine and passed over that £15. But then where do you stop? And this is our dinner table conversation, which I think brings home for me the purpose of social enterprise. If I only gave what I had to make a difference in terms of financial sense, if I focused on charity, where do I stop? When I've given a kidney or when I've given the second kidney? You know, where do I stop trying to make good happen? I will run out of personal resources. So there has to be a smarter way. So I've got two options. As an employee, I could focus on getting richer and richer and do whatever I do does that. It's not going to make me happy. And this is already about purpose. Or I can find a way through business or through a job to actually use the skills and the experience that I've got to apply them to a different way of thinking in business to make good happen. Now, you heard earlier about the £4 million. So £1 million of that was in the last year, and our run rate's increased, so £4 million. And I'm hugely, hugely proud of that figure. But I'm more proud of the fact that this business is now at a stage it can be sustainable without me. It can go on, and it can continue to give way beyond the energy that I can give it. And I could go and do something else. I haven't decided what yet or when, but the theory is there. But what's really interesting is there are only 9 people that work at Blue. And I think this is the final point for me about social enterprise and what makes it really, really different, is 9 people with skills derived in working at Tesco's, in Amazon, in a wine merchant's, in a charity, and where else have I got people from? But I mean, you get the picture, from normal jobs, but with personal purpose, working together in a business model that thinks differently and innovates and only invests, it never spends. We never spend £15, you only ever invest it because we know it can return. Is what if you nine could each get together and form a business and work a business that could pay you all a decent wage and deliver £1 million a year to making good happen in the world? Or not deliver the £1 million, but reinvest that £1 million and making some good happen. there are lots and lots and lots of social enterprises in the UK already, and we talk about ourselves as a bit of a hidden revolution. There are 100,000 social enterprises in the UK, contributing £60 billion to the economy. That's about 3% of our GDP, the same as agriculture, and employing 2 million people. And it's an exciting place to be, and it feels as if we're a hidden movement but about to have our time. And as I said earlier, you could, social enterprises take many, many forms. You may have got on a London bus that's a social enterprise. You may have bought a refillable water bottle. Like me, you might have this belt is made from recycled fire hose, and this bag is made from offcuts of leather by a social enterprise. What else have I got? My necklace is made by a women's beading cooperative. There are so many things that you can invest in, because this bag and belt will last forever, guaranteed for life. Or simply choose to spend your pounds differently. Choose to buy social, because actually in talking about that gift, I often give products made out of fire hose from Elvis and Cressy to my friends, because in talking about that gift, the story of the impact that they're having is immense. So you're stopping a beautiful, you know, disused, discarded material becoming landfill. And by the way, 50% of that profits there goes to the retired firefighters fund. Or maybe you could invite, anybody got your own business? Okay. Maybe you could invite your employees to a team building day. My shoes, I actually made these myself. But I was able to make them myself because of an organization called Juta Shoes, beautiful social enterprise, bringing ladies who are marginalized, usually refugees, struggling to find work. But instead of teaching these ladies how to make our shoes, they teach these ladies how to teach us to make our own blinking shoes. And that, for me, just demonstrates how social enterprises think beyond the norm, think beyond the curve, and do differently. If you want to know more about social enterprise as a concept, we're going to have some questions shortly. But Social Enterprise UK have a wonderful, wonderful website with all sorts of information on structures or how to start up, lots of examples on different social enterprises, ways to get involved when we have our Buy Social campaign days. Lots of opportunities to maybe you find out about local social enterprises in your area and get involved. And of course, lots and lots of charities are now looking at how they can set up their own social enterprises, because of course, finding non-restricted funds to do the much needed work that you do is becoming harder and harder and harder. And you know, charities won't all be as lucky as WaterAid to find partners like Blue who want to work in that way. So start your own. You know, save some of us from banking. Save some of us from, you know, jobs that aren't fulfilling us with purpose, and take our skill sets and our experience and help us find a way to do something that's more meaningful for us on the planet in which we live, so we can all get through it to better. These are pretty tough times we're facing right now. I'm noticing friends no longer be friends, families falling out with families, businesses having tough times, and unnecessary distraction and shortages from things that are very important. And if there's one thing I can say from the heart, is that if you find like-minded employees, colleagues, friends, family, to just share these ideas with, just maybe some of them will come off. And if none of them come off, at least you've had a great time thinking and talking about them. So, thank you.
Okay, I will endeavour to come round with a microphone. Questions for Karen, comments, contributions? Who'd like to start us off? I'm looking around. Might be brave. Well, let me start us off then, Karen, just with a slightly provocative question. You mentioned the scale of the social enterprise movement. When you compare the scale of the social enterprise movement to mainstream business, it's very clear that actually, you mentioned Blue has a kind of 3% market share. That means that 97% of the market share sits elsewhere and sits with some much bigger organisations, conglomerates. You mentioned some of the organisations that end up owning. Do you think that it's possible to really have an impact on the way organisations of that size and scale do business?
So you can, but only if you compete well enough to get noticed, i.e. make it a fight. Or the alternative is how do you inspire them? So go back to what I was saying about, I think, you know, each of us in business needs to try and inspire our customers, our partners and our employees. And I think rather than just get on and compete, sometimes having those collaborative conversations is a good way forward. I mean, you're starting to see, I spoke about a year ago on a panel with Paul Polman of Unilever, and you're starting to see some people, particularly at the later end of their career, some CEOs have very, very different views. I think the issue we've got with it is a lot of shareholders don't take kindly to that because they've invested their pounds or their pension and wanting pounds return. And I think we as a species just kind of haven't made that connection yet. You know, the biggest thing that we can do to influence the big businesses is as with our pension funds and as consumers, and those two things together, if we can find a way to connect them with what those businesses do, then together we can redefine value. But it's not easy. It's not easy at all. Hello.
There we go.
Thank you for that. It was really interesting. As someone who is kind of looking to where they want to go in their life, but knows that the climate emergency is like the biggest crisis we are facing, and everyone who normally cares about this will go into charities, go into civil disobedience. But is there a say for going into business, or is that just all going to end up as greenwash and actually doesn't really make any difference at all?
Is it safer, did you say, to go into business?
Is it
So I think the biggest opportunity for our young people today is to do two things, and we need half to do one, half the other. We need half of them, and they are starting their social enterprises, disruptive businesses. They don't want to wait. They want to have purpose within the brand, and they want to appeal to the audiences because they're better, genuinely better, you know, in terms of the environment in which we live and what we need. And I think that's great. I think we need the other half to go into big business and be disruptive from within, because I think you can disrupt by inspiring and giving great ideas and great challenge and drawing attention to the disruptors on the outside. So I think we need to do both. There are some great examples, but I wouldn't, of young people leading young businesses who've not got very big but made a huge difference. I mentor a lady called Jenny from Rubies in the Rubble. They divert what would have been food waste from Waitrose, and they make it into chutneys and to jams. And their business isn't massive, but actually it got Waitrose going, we want to talk about this. Right now we need to focus on all our waste. So I think that is the point. We need to aggravate. I mean, what I didn't say about Blue in the onset is the original funder of Blue was Gordon Roddick. And I'm sure you'll remember Gordon Anita Roddick. And she had a very famous saying, which is, if you think you're too small to make a difference, try going to bed with a mosquito.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm in construction, work for PLC, so corporate social responsibility is very strong on our agenda. We work in the public sector, so it's actually compulsory to get onto frameworks. It's difficult sometimes. Some of it, a lot what you do is under CSR is really what we should be doing anyhow, like apprenticeships. It's often difficult. Some of it seems a bit tokenism sometimes. Is there opportunity for a social enterprise to operate from within a business? Within a PLC, you can have a social enterprise that can deliver something aside to it.
So really good question. And the answer is yes. So we've seen lots of social enterprises have been spin outs to the NHS, for example, because the belief is they can be run better separately. There is nothing stopping us having a spin in. We've seen some Cordon Group of we're a normal for-profit business and becoming a social enterprise. I love the idea of a spin-in. I think it needs one strong champion within the organisation to convince CSR that CSR is dead and we need to do it differently. And if I were in construction, I'd probably be looking at Waits, for example, who are huge supporters of an initiative called Buy Social. Buy Social is a Social Enterprise UK initiative where we bring lots of big businesses like Waits, Johnson & Johnson, and bring them together, and they're focusing on how much of their supply chain can they buy from social enterprises to truly integrate within the business. I've got a Buy Social brochure with me, actually, construction... You know, it needs one champion internally to knock on the right doors, make a bit of noise, and who knows what change you could make and what's to lose.
And just to add to that, there are some interesting organisations in the construction sector trying to do stuff differently. So Yeah, definitely worth pursuing. There's a hand over there.
Hi.
Hello.
Thank you for what you've just said, and thanks for your water. It tastes really good. I've had lots of it. I think that there's real value in the PLC model, if only we can unearth it. As you've alluded to, we all own these companies in our pension funds, in our managed ISAs, and for one change of financial legislation, which is technically absolutely possible in this day and age, to devolve the voting power down to the underlying owner of the stock, so that it doesn't get stuck at the fund manager level, suddenly you flip it on its head, and now when Tesco's get at an AGM, they get told by the shareholders who own Tesco's in their pension fund to do away with single use or whatever it may be, suddenly you have real power in the public limited company. And if only we find a way to bring that to people's attention and to bring it to politicians, because it favours the right on politics, because it's all about the power of the individual, and of course it favours the left because it's about social responsibility too.
Yeah, and there is a great thing worth following online run by BAFTA Corp at the moment called The Future of the Corporation, and that is exactly the space that they're... Are you okay? that they're looking at currently is to how could we think differently, but it's very difficult when you've got an established model with existing shareholders, existing power, and to get that movement, and way beyond my area of specialism, other than I know I want it. And I guess that brings me to something worth mentioning is saying what you want to happen and actually doing it are sometimes two different things. And we always said at Blue, you know, that, you know, we'd like to put ourselves out of business. Genuinely, we only exist because people are still buying mineral water in bottles. And if we could convince everybody to buy tap and not buy our product, then we wouldn't do it anymore. And you can say that, but it's really hard to convince people that that's what you're doing unless you do it. And we spent... six years trying to convince people to get rid of buying our product and to have filtration systems in their restaurants. And we would give, in the end, we started giving them to them for free. If they would give up the revenue, we'll give it to you for free. You've got it for free. We'll service it. We'll change the filters. We'll give you the bottles. And when people come and dine, give them the opportunity to donate £1 for Water Aid. And we make some good happen from that. So we're basically funding filtration systems from the sale of bottled water, using those to give diners still and sparkling water without cost to the outlet. The diner puts in the pound and we transform lives. And we've won a Queen's Award for innovation on the business model, but it's taken us 7 years nearly to get that to be about 25% of the business, because there is a very small, I guess, part of any community that are being vocal that actually... their behaviours follow suit. And I think, you know, the bottled water market grew by 11% last year. Who could believe that? I mean, we had a hot summer, but off the back of all the Blue Planet coverage. And I think we live in a world where our bubble is the bubble that we make. And ironically, now in bottled water, we're now going through it. Everybody believes cans are better. Well, cans have got four times the carbon footprint of a bottle of water. And a plastic bottle is completely recyclable again and again and again. And yet we're convincing ourselves that a can is better. Or a carton. You know, 90% of all those Tetra Paks we use at home, I have stopped using them now, never get recycled because you can't separate them. And the plastic liner is the one that becomes marine plastics, those tiny little... But I can see how it's so easy for people to go, I don't want to feel bad by having a plastic bottle, so I'll buy a can. And that's what big business is doing to people, doing to us. And we haven't all got the time. We're too busy thinking, you know, how much is the phone bill going to be? Are the kids okay? Did I remember to get the prescription for the dog at the vet? You know, we haven't got the time to read every carton, every piece of press coverage, read everything and make a truly informed decision on everything. And that's why business has to solve the problems that we're facing, and why we as consumers need to man up and make sure the businesses that we spend our pounds with do a better job.
Hi. I'm Alison. I was one of the spin-outs. I manage a small spin-out from the NHS, which was founded really on prevention of harm of the specialty in which I work. So I was interested in what you were saying about Blue when their original sort of mission was like, stop doing this or something. I just wondered whether you've got any more comments to say on the spin that you put on a different story to enable people to feel more at ease.
yes, really, really simple. And you know, I've got my kids have just left home. But you know when the instinct when things aren't going right is to just cut to the chase and go, this is what we want to have happen. Because time's, you know, precious and we're all really busy. And I think it's about taking time to be on that journey of where we're going. But most importantly, not just what we want to do different, which is why. And to not have anybody feeling guilty or feeling bad so that they disengage. It was all about, for us, communication of the WaterAid story, about by choosing us, here's what good we can make happen together. So come and join us and look at what we will do. And by the way, in doing that, here are all the other benefits that had happened. So it's very much about why, very much about benefits, but also making it really easy in terms of how, which I guess brings to one very short but important point is you can have premium products and you can have mid-price products and you can have cheap products. But what you can't do is you can't make a product exactly the same as everybody else's and charge more just because you're a social enterprise. That's charity. So it's very, you know, whether it's a, whether your stakeholder or beneficiary is a person or a business, I think thinking through what the proposition is to them and why this makes more sense and how to get there, it just needs to be slick and needs to be straightforward, but needs to be warm and inspiring. And then it needs a good handhold along the way.
Hi, I'm working starting up a social enterprise, and I was just wondering if you had any view on things like the legal structures, how you go about it. You can be a charity, you can be a cooperative, you can be all sorts of things, and fair shares and all kind of stuff. Have you had any experience of pros and cons and how that fits together with effectively wanting to run a business but with all this other stuff around it?
Yes, it's one of those hot topics, and there's a great section on the website, and we were talking about it earlier. I think there's about 30 different structures at last count. Now, Blue, we have as a limited company limited by shares, two types of shares, voting shares, profit shares. All the profit shares are held by the foundation, so completely asset locked. And what that means is theoretically best of both worlds. We're 100% trading revenue, but back in the early day, we did get a grant which came through the foundation. But I think for me, it creates almost two organisations. One's focusing on social impact and one's focusing on the environmental impact of making the product. You probably get some better advice here.
I was gonna say, it would be remiss of me not to say that I'm David Alcock from Anthony Collins Solicitors, and the questions you've just asked, that's what I do in my day job. I help set structures up for people. So I guess in this context, I don't want to kind of take away from what Karen's got to say, but what I would say is that ownership makes a real difference, which is a very kind of common sense-y sort of point. But actually, the way a business is owned determines who ultimately gets to say what happens. So one of the reasons why PLCs are the way they are is that actually we have a legal principle built into that whole relationship around shareholder value, which means that actually there's a set of short-term assumptions that get made about who benefits. So our friends at Central England will tell you that actually being owned by your customers creates a really different set of relationships. So I would just say that ownership makes a huge difference. I think there are about 7 or 8 structures, really. And the basic difference is whether or not you want to give out profits to your owners or you don't, whether you want to reinvest them for the business in some way, shape or form. And then my advice usually kind of goes from there, from that basic choice. But do come and talk to us.
But just to add to that, the difference between voting rights and profits, two very different things, because I have had very differing experiences, and I've vowed I will no longer be a trustee because, you know, you want the best from people, but you're not allowed to pay them. And there's something there about, and the environments I've always been in with trustees, really, really risk adverse. And actually in business, what you want is you want ambition and you want growth. You don't want, you know, if you shy away from every risk, your business will get smaller and smaller and you won't have one. So I think about voting and profits as two different things, and think about impact and think about trading as two different things. And then from the, you know, find what structure that suits you. But I don't think it matters that much in the beginning until you've actually got proof of concept in your idea. I think it matters a lot if you're building a brand and you want evidence that you're not just trying to, you know, greenwash or con people and make 10 million and run off to the Bahamas. You know, I think, you know, we publish an impact report every year. Our accounts are completely, we publish full accounts online, fully audited accounts, even though we're not over 10 million, so we don't have to. It might even be 15 million now. We turn over £6 million, so we don't, but we do it because being honest and transparent allows us to do two things. It allows us to build more trust in the brand, but it allows others to learn from us too. And whereas normally, you know, companies hide their numbers away like this and don't want anyone to see, our view is the more we share, the more chance we have of doing better together.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to ask you a bit about getting your product out there in terms of the sales and marketing costs. Because certainly from my line of work, it's very difficult to get a product, especially a product like water in bottles that we can buy all sorts of different brands without attending things like big expensive trade shows or without putting a lot of money into social media and into marketing campaigns and all of that. And those things cost a lot of money. And if you're just a small social enterprise, or how has Baloo done it?
Okay.
Because I know that trying to get our products out there is difficult and expensive. So where do you get that money from?
So we don't spend much money at all. So we turn over £6 million and our annual marketing spend for everything, and it's about £32,000. So it's less than 0.5% of turnover. So we're not the norm. The thinking in the business is to do it differently, to be creative. And what would we do if we had money is the most important thing. And then how do we do it without the money? And, you know, I get asked to speak at lots of bigger businesses because of that, because traditionally marketing departments spend what money they've got. I mean, you know, I used to spend millions a quarter in my Barclays days. So you don't need a lot of money, but you do need a really, really clear focus. So we are very clear. Number one, we're a B2B marketing message, right? I can never have enough money to try and tell every consumer out in the UK about Baloo. And even if I did have, they're not going to choose their restaurant depending on what water they stock, because how are they even going to know? So my marketing focus is all around influence. So I focused on getting Raymond Blanc on side, getting Jamie Oliver on side. So all of the key chefs, and then all restaurateurs, because if one restaurateur chooses Baloo, then he's influencing the water choice of thousands of people. And then once I've got the decision maker on the site on board, I'm then getting to know his staff and training his staff, because when they work in a restaurant and they know the water they serve transforms lives, and that from an environmental perspective, it's their best option. If they move and go to a different restaurant, what are they going to tell the boss? And actually, most of our business comes from referral. And hence, we've got to the point 9 years in where we spend little. We do use social enterprise. We've built our website to optimize in terms of SEO. But I think you can do it on not a lot. We spent £15,000 in total to design the brand and launch the brand, but that was 9 years ago now. And that included our website. Do those sound scary numbers to you?
No.
If I can help.
Certainly in the very initial stages for a social enterprise, very little money. How do you get it out there without speculating and to accumulate?
So I'm a great believer in not creating product and then going to sell it, actually. I'm a great believer in finding a customer, finding out what they need and making it with them. So they're with you on the journey. So by the time you go, you're about to press the button and spend the money, you've already got your first customer, so it works. So you've got some business to be covering your overhead while you go and look for your second one. And of course, if you're only looking for one customer, you want a decent sized one. But by all means, grab my number. If I can help, I will.
Hi. When you were talking about the thinner glass bottles and you know, selling that idea to your competitors, basically, I thought, I mean, obviously that's very, very brave. But I mean, you kind of touched on it, especially the, you know, being happy if you're put out of business kind of thing. But doesn't that, can you tell us a bit more about that? You know, how the thought process behind that all kind of
sure.
You know, doesn't it worry you that you might be putting your own employees out of a job?
It's a really, really good question, and perhaps I didn't explain it well enough. Here's my view is I'm not going to put every other competitor. I wouldn't be so arrogant as to think I can put every other water brand out of business in the UK. But if I'm not going to win that business, but I make some money because their product's in my bottle, that's better than not winning it, isn't it? So for me, I looked at it as additional business. So I think the technical term for creating your own bottles, if you're a water business, is vertical integration. But I looked at it also as kind of horizontal penetration into the market. So if Prince's Gate win a Welsh restaurant, well, they're much stronger in Wales than we are, but they're buying our bottles and every bottle gives a penny to WaterAid, that means, you know, they sell enough of them, I transform a life. It just, it's the right thing to do on both counts. One, their footprint goes down, and two, they transform more lives. That money all comes through us, so it's another revenue stream. And actually, if I purely became a glass business, would that be a bad thing? It might be easier than doing mineral water. Who knows? But we have a set of values that whenever we're struggling to, you know, we've got a dilemma, we have a set of values we live by. And, you know, the biggest one is, and environmentally, is it a good thing to do? Does it take you forward? Because if the answer to that is yes, we have to work really hard to find a reason not to do it, even if it costs us more, because we have faith that in the marketplace, you know, if you do it, you know, build it and people will come. Not everyone. We're not trying to be the cheapest and the biggest. We're trying to evidence what better looks like continuously. And it is a continuous journey.
Okay, we've just got time for a couple more. Anybody who's not asked a question so far who wants to stick a hand up? Yes, gentlemen, right back. One more after this we'll take if we can.
Hi. It's just a question from the other side. So if like me, I haven't got an idea for a social enterprise project, but I've got, say, in my case, IT skills that I'd like to find someone to work with and offer those skills. How should I go about that?
Super. Actually, it's one of the things I think we need to do at Social Enterprise UK is start a register of people exactly like you who want to get involved and donate their skills, because I don't want you going through the experience that I had when I wrote to my favourite charities and realised that I loved them.
To be fair, I didn't hear him say he wanted to donate his skills. Maybe he wants to get paid for doing IT work, which would be fine.
Both. I mean, I would always recommend the best way into the sector to find paid employment is do a little bit of part-time volunteering. So the bit I love about the charity space is this concept of volunteering, because that gifts both ways. There's always so much learning and because you might find it's not for you at all, actually. So I would go to Social Enterprise UK's job board if you were looking at a role. I think we at Social Enterprise UK should start a register of people who would like to make their skills available. I would start my research, if I were you, looking at who is already in the sector and what do they do. And then I'd go, forget the social enterprise bit. If I was just using my IT skills to make a difference, what would it be? I mean, my personal motto is find out what you're good at and do something good with it. It's really, really simple. But if you can work through that, then why not that? Because there's no better place to start.
Thank you. We have time for one more. Yes.
Thank you very much. I hadn't realised you weren't the person who was meant to be speaking to us tonight, but thank you for what you have said. But you rather enigmatically said at the beginning that you disagreed with him on a number of things. So perhaps you could outline what they
one
are
of the ones.
For us.
I'll give you one. So I feel very passionately about a form of asset locking. Now, not every social entrepreneur does. I'm a bit of a purist. And the reason I've kind of got to that space is because of the job I do now. So within my marketplace, there are some people who say they're social enterprises, but there's no asset lock at all. And they could turn around tomorrow, sell that business, take their £5 million and go and sit on the beach. Whereas I've structured my business around building a brand, a value, that if that business were ever sold, that all of those monies would go to why you've bought it in the first place. So from a brand perspective, and that's all my background, I think you make a promise and you have to deliver on it. And for me, asset locking and that, if you're a social enterprise, is really, really important. But there are different models, and Peter is much more inclusive in his approach. One, because he wants our movement to be bigger and he wants that bigger number. I don't think he's wrong. I don't think purist is wrong, and I don't think, you know, very inclusive and take everybody on their word is right. You know, I don't, it's somewhere in the middle, but it's a bit about, you know, right now we are a mass of loads and loads of, and I've seen lots messages about, you know, this straw, you know, is not plastic. It bloody well is. You know, somebody's just printed a cardboard box, shoved them in there, charged a bit more, and is getting away with it. You know, and not all entrepreneurs, you know, are in business for the right reason. A lot of entrepreneurs see an opportunity to make some cash and crack on. So that's one example where I think, you know, if and because I'm a brand person, if you want to really give the people who are going to spend their hard-earned cash, you know, a risk-free chance to participate in our sector, I think for me, asset lock's really important. I think it's less of an issue in service brands or in healthcare and education, but certainly in consumer-facing brands. And I think you can have, you've not seen Peter speak at all. No, I think you must, actually.
Well, if he can, we'll invite him back next year and see if he comes this time. So,
well, maybe we could both come and we could have a bit of a debate. We could do a for and against, yeah.
Okay. We are out of time, but can you please join with me in thanking Karen Lynch, everybody?
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. At Greenbelt, we make a space where artistry meets activism, where the political meets the practical, where the sacred meets the secular. We think we're somewhere to dream up a better world, to dance and debate, to pray and to party. Visit greenbelt.org.uk to browse and download other great thinking from our recorded catalogue. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in.